Okay, thank you very much. Yes. And the title we put down was not, I mean, it's not wrong, because I'm going to be discussing various issues about explaining human action, but I want to concentrate on reductive modes of explanation, actually two, which are not the same but are very often operating in synergy. And I want to raise the issue about these, and I obviously stand very hostile to both these, but I won't be mainly laying out the arguments today for why they're wrong, but trying to understand how they work, how they convince people, how they sometimes work against each other, sometimes work for each other. So there's two kinds of reduction I want to talk about. And reduction one is the form that you see, for instance, in a certain kind of maybe vulgarized Marxism. And the microphones aren't working. Okay, some of these are purely for recording purposes. I think this one is the one that's operative as the PA. Does this, that sound right as I move it? Okay, so so I'll stay close to that. All right, so that you see it as a vulgar Marxism, in other words, which takes the various human goals, splits them into two, and ranks them very differently. On one hand, you have the goals that have to do with human life, making the means to life, human reproduction, the kind of goals that we share with all sorts of other animals, on one hand. On the other hand, you have other kinds of higher goals, that, so-called higher goals that arise in human culture, moral aims, ethical goals, aesthetic judgments, and so on, right? And the this kind of reduction undercuts the second class in favor of the first class, and that in two ways. Number one, when it comes to the issue of explanation, there's a kind of explanatory reduction. I mean, famously, the kind of more vulgar kind of Marxism says what actually moves history, what actually explains why history changes and new modes of production arise is the value that they have as modes of production. And then we can explain why different ideologies, different religious views, different legal systems come into place, because they subserve the development of this new mode of production, and therefore that's why they're happening. So the, if you like, our human beings' intrinsic interest in these religious or moral or other doctrines is given second place in the explanatory framework to these basic, let's call them, life goals. And another way in which the reduction occurs, which weaves into the explanatory reduction, is to allow that the kinds of things we are responding to when we're seeking the life goals are real, so we're factors in the world, and the kinds of things we think we're responding to when we're seeking the so-called higher goals are not. They're some, in some sense, projection. So when people alter their mode of production because they find that they can produce more and more people can survive and so on, they're plainly, in doing that, responding to a reality. There really is a greater chance for human life and greater means for life involved in this mode of production as against that. But when people respond to a certain way of living because it's allegedly ethically higher, this is not responding to something, as it were, really there. This discrimination is not anchored in reality, but it's something that is projected by themselves. They have this sense that they feel this way, or they have a sense that this is the case. They feel this way either because human beings just always do as a matter of brute fact, or they feel this way because in certain accounts, being members of this society and this mode of production, they find themselves drawn to it because it's as it were, favoring and helping along this mode of production. So you have both explanatory reduction here. The real explanatory motivations are at this level, but you have also another kind of reduction in which, now I want to introduce this word meanings. This word I want to introduce not in the sense of linguistic meaning, but in the sense where we could speak of the significance of X for me or the significance of Y for me or for you and so on, the meaning it has in my life. I prefer meaning to significance because for some reason in English, the word significance doesn't pluralize well. It's significances. It sounds terribly like jargon. And I like to tell myself I'm not using jargon, but of course we all really do, you know. So I'll use this word meanings. All right, so let's look at that again from the standpoint of meanings. That a certain alternative way of organizing production is better in terms of the sustaining of life. That's the meaning it has for them. It's something that's better because it sustains more life. This judgment of meaning, this perception of meaning, is perception of something real. It really does. I mean, it's not something that they've invented. It's not something just a matter of how they feel. It's not something that they're projecting on the world. It's something that is really there that they have recognized. But that is a certain mode of life, that of contemplation of philosophy or the citizen life or what have you, is a higher mode of life than other modes. That can't be seen. That there's a meaning there. The life, the theoretical life, let's look at Aristotle, right? The theoretical life is the, in a certain sense, the highest mode for human beings. It's the mode that he says in the book 10 of the Ethics is the closest to the divine, right? This perception is not a real perception. It's not as if we're grasping some reality there. There isn't an objective fact of the matter that shows the theoretical life to be higher than other modes of life. But it is something you have to explain itself in terms of the way in which human beings feel, maybe in this society, maybe in general, but it has to be, as it were, explained. They're projecting that superiority onto this otherwise, you know, inert reality is something you have to explain. See, there's a matter of meanings that are ultimately projections, meanings that are real perceptions. When you get them, you get them right, and you can really show that this meaning really inheres in things. Now, in this mode of production, it really has the consequence of allowing more people to live and survive and so on, and that's something it really has. In the other case, it's something projected. Now, let's look at the evolution of this kind of reduction in our history, and I want to look at it very quickly. I want to look at Aristotle, I want to look at Hume. And all this in order to extract very quickly a kind of typology of different kinds of meanings, some of which are clearly simply, as it were, projections on our part or things that we just happen to feel, and some of which are plainly meanings that we really perceive and that you can get right or wrong, and that if you get it wrong, you can tell people why they've got it wrong and so on. So the typology of different kinds of meanings. And let's look at this is a terribly rapid thing. I just want to use Aristotle for a few seconds, Hume for a few seconds, and a couple of other references to set up this typology, which we can then, in such a sense, play around with. Because a lot of ethical discussion today really turns on where in this typology you situate, you know, the important ethical insights. And I would could go off into that, and that would take us 3 or 4 hours, and it would be fascinating. But I want to not do that in order to connect up to another kind of reduction and see how that works together with the kind I'm just describing now. So I'll try to go through this relatively quickly. All right, let's take the first model, and I'm taking sort of Aristotle, Plato. And there in the ethical writings of these authors and others like them, you have certain modes of action together with the motives implicit in them, which are picked out as objectively higher than others. And this is the object of a strong evaluation. So Aristotle's theoria, that is contemplation, that is the disinterested, if you like, contemplation and understanding of the world, of our lives, and so on. Or Aristotle again, the life of the citizen, participating in the government together with other citizens of the polis, as against a lower form, the life of the householder, which is, of course, also important for Aristotle, also essential, creating the means to life for the family. of course, higher again than the life of simply the one who enjoys drinking a lot of wine, particularly if they don't cut it with water and so on. So you get a hierarchy there. And the belief is that this hierarchy is objective, and it is the task of reason, logos, it is the task of reason to discern this. And as a matter of fact, of course, Plato and Aristotle have a lot. Actually, there are tons of empty spaces that I see here. If you like sitting on the floor, I'm not paternalistic. I won't make a virtue of sitting on a chair. But just if you want to, they're there. Well, it is the task of reason, and even you might say with Plato, it's clearly how he thinks of reason as the capacity that we have to discern this kind of order, this kind of ranking. But then, of course, there are other examples. You have Christian view of agape, of charity. Plainly, that is one of the theological virtues, right? See where the word virtue comes in very easily here. It's seen to be intrinsically higher. Or you think, in more contemporary terms of some people thinking of their career. And some people might think, well, I really want to be a composer, a writer, an artist, because these are really, really significant careers. My dad wants me to go to law school, but et cetera. So you get that kind of judgment. See, this is the sense that this is something really more important. Or it may be, in the modern day, personalized because of the modern notion of identity. This is, for me, what's really important. But this kind of discernment is what I'm talking about as model one. It's the kind that you can still model on the ancient philosophy, Plato and Aristotle type of structure. And it follows, of course, here, very strong sense that you can get it wrong. There's an objective correctness here, right? And that the whole Nicomachean Ethics is meant to take you from, Aristotle's method is to lay out at the beginning all the things that people think are the good life. The good life is a word for this, this higher or the proper ordering of one's different goals. He takes you through a whole lot of arguments to get you to see that if you thought that it was simply a life of pleasure, you thought there was simply a life of money making, you got it wrong. That can't be it. Let's come to the point where you can see that this is the right order. Now, I want in the end to have four categories, which I might even rush up and put on the board in a minute, but I don't know if that's technically conceivable. At the very antipodes of this idea, of this meaning, the meaning for Aristotle that the contemplative life has as the highest, most divine mode of human action, the very opposite of that is something like, I had to use an example like this, but I find it very useful, the notion, the meaning of the nauseating. Certain things just nauseate us. I can say this in a four-letter word, but let me say excrement. Just human beings find nauseating. This is at the absolute antipodes, clearly, from what Aristotle thinks is the status of the theoretical life. It's just a brute fact that we find, and not even all of us, but that some of us, most of us, find certain things nauseating. You can perhaps train yourself, understand in the army, people wade through the Marines, pigs' guts and so on, in order that they won't throw up when they're in the battlefield, etc. And you can actually train yourself not to be nauseated. Okay, so then it's not nauseating anymore. Right? There's no real underlying fact of the matter. You're not wrong. You can't be, if you don't find it nauseating, you can't be convinced. Hey, listen, think for a minute, ponder, Don't you see that? No, it's just a brute fact, right? So we have, at the other end of the spectrum, we have a set of meanings which are impervious to reason. You can't be talked into or out of them. You can deviate from the majority in your perception or non-perception of them. You find you're terribly trembly, you find a lot of things nauseating and people don't, or you're terribly tough and you find a lot of things nauseating that people, perfectly okay that people find nauseating. Okay. You're not right, you're not wrong, you're just different. See, it's just a brute fact. Okay. Now, somewhere between these two extremes is situated a modern theory which I think, really was most persuasively launched by Hume. And I'd like to look at that now. And this, there's an immense amount of ink is spilt about this, and I'm sure I'm going to offend somebody in the hall here who says, that's not what Hume meant. And I mean, probably you're right. But anyway, I want to make Hume mean something. Anyway, experimentally make Hume mean a certain thing, which it gives us a clear contrast. Now, Hume does seem to be kind of an anti-Aristotle, because I'm taking from the Inquiry. He's much more brutal and upfront in the treatise. And, of course, was it because the treatise was a flop? Anyway, or did he really change his mind? Let's forget that. Let's just take the Inquiry. Okay? And he poses the question very early about the foundations of morals, quote, whether they be derived from reason or from sentiment. Reason or sentiment. Now, his first answer is that both seem to have a case, because we do argue about certain moral issues, about right and wrong. But on the other hand, it seems that, I'm now going to give another quote, the final sentence, it is probable, which pronounces characters and actions amiable or odious, praiseworthy or blamable, that which stamps on them the mark of honor or infamy, approbation or censure, that which renders morality an active principle and constitutes virtue or happiness, and vice our misery. It is probable, I say, that this final sentence depends on some internal sense or feeling which nature has made universal in the whole species. Right? Now, what seems to be being said here is that the ultimate, as it were, judgment on which this all hangs is just a sentiment, just how we feel, just how nature has made it. In a way, at that level, it's like nature has made us to find certain things nauseating, nature has made us to find certain things approvable, and certain other things condemnable. Now, this seems to be a brute fact about us. I mean, the notion of brute fact is a key concept here. And it's not the deliverance of reason that we, let's say, approve virtue and abhor vice, as it seems to be for Aristotle. But this sentiment is not like our reaction to nausea, because it's directed towards certain human qualities, and we sometimes need to reason in order to determine whether these human qualities exist in a given case or not, whether they apply to the case or not. Hume seems to make a contrast case to morality in this regard when he looks at what we call aesthetics, judgments of beauty. Because he does say in this same discussion, some species of beauty, especially the natural kinds, which on their first appearance command our affection and approbation, he talks, there are some, and where they fail of this effect, it is impossible for any reasoning to redress their influence or adapt them better to our taste or sentiment. So these particular judgments, it would appear, aesthetic judgments we have, this is a beautiful landscape, seems to me he's saying there it's rather like the case of nausea, that, you know, ordinarily people say, wow, it's the Grand Canyon. But if somebody says, Grand Canyon, I mean, you know, hole in the ground, then you can't say anything to them about that. But he does want to make the contrast, note here, between the moral and the aesthetic. This is interesting because, of course, the origin of Hume's position is Hutcheson and the Scottish moral sense theory, and Hutcheson rehabilitated in a certain sense as a specific kind of feeling, the moral sense, but he also rehabilitated as another specific kind of feeling, the sense of beauty, the aesthetic sense, right? So you have Hume, and they were equally given a kind of good status by Hutcheson, and Hume you find already distinguishing them. So he says, in order to pave the way for the moral sentiment, see, as against this aesthetic one, and to get a proper discernment of its object, it is often necessary, we find, that much reasoning should precede and nice distinctions be made, just conclusions drawn, distant comparisons formed, complicated relations examined, and general facts fixed and ascertained. So we have something intermediary between the Nolzia case and the Aristotle case, where there's a foundation of just basically that we approve of certain things, but where we sometimes have to argue a great deal about whether the object before us really belongs to the class that we approve of or disapprove of. It may not be obvious at all, and you may have to go through all these things that he mentions here, comparisons, complications, and so on. So what do we then admire as a matter of fact? What do we approve? Well, Hume, when he turns to examine this question, takes the example of the, he calls them benevolent or softer affections, which, whenever they appear, engage the approbation and goodwill of mankind. Again, another quote, "No qualities are more entitled to the general goodwill and approbation of mankind than beneficence and humanity, friendship and gratitude, natural affection and public spirit, or whatever proceeds from a tender sympathy with others and a generous concern for our kind and species." Now, Hume's speaking here about what is entitled to our approbation. But I think, and here's where Humeans are going to disagree, he's here speaking with the vulgar, is where he's offering an expression of a common sentiment. The word entitled here, you see, really rings Aristotle, right? I mean, this is the right thing to approve of. But I think he's really offering an expression of common sentiment. And for Hume, this sentiment can be explained as a joint creation of two other motives, and two other values we universally share. And one is what he calls utility. That is, whatever conduces to life, to health, and the fulfillment of non-harmful desire in human beings, that is something which is useful. But it isn't only our own utility. The thing is that we are endowed, in Hume's view, with sympathy. So we have this reaction to whatever conduces to utility in general, not just for me, but for people in general. And this, he thinks, is the Hutchesonian special mode of feeling, which he, like Hutchison, thinks is phenomenologically distinct. I mean, we sense that there's a difference when we are moved to approve this wonderful, generous action somebody else has done, just quite different people. I mean, we even do this back in time and think that so-and-so who lived in the past can't have any effect on us, was a very generous person, or another Nero was an awful tyrant, and we approve or disapprove. And we have the sense that this is a different kind of feeling from the anger I have when you take my purse or you know, et cetera, rob me, et cetera, and so on. He's following the Scottish tradition. Now, just because it's the real occurrence of benevolence and not simply the semblance of it, there's always room for argument. You see, perhaps the philanthropist is actually weaving a scheme to get somebody under his control and is just giving out, you know, goodies in order to do that. Or perhaps we see somebody taking a knife to someone else and we say, stop this cruel man, and it turns out to be a surgeon taking out a dangerous tumor. So we can be corrected. Our first-off reactions can be corrected. And Hume is I get sucked into this. You get very interesting because it's wonderful, sort of exhibit A of the development of the 18th century concept of polite society and the sense of having moved to a further stage in human development from the ancients. So there's a wonderful passage in the Inquiry where he points out the ancients, he says, disapproved of, quote, luxury or a refinement on the pleasures and conveniences of life, unquote, because they thought this to be, quote, the source of every corruption in government and the immediate cause of faction, sedition, civil wars, and the total loss of liberty. And this is certainly true. I mean, you hear Cato, and you can hear Cato inveighing against the corruptions arising in society. But, says Hume, we moderns, who now attempt to prove that such refinements rather tend to the increase of industry, civility, and arts, regulate anew our moral as well as our political sentiments, and represent as laudable or innocent what had formerly been regarded as pernicious and blamable. In other words, if you read my colleague Adam Smith, you will understand that the search for luxury has a quite different role in our society and helps to not only produce prosperity, but it also helps us to get out of the world in which war-making was the major virtue, right? And rather peaceful production, peaceful exchange is the major virtue. And you see, so what he sees here is that this ability for reason to change our sentiments of moral approbation is something that operates as well in history. What really is underlying this, we have come to discover that the search for luxury is not necessarily harmful, it's not necessarily undermining human good, on the contrary. And when we've done that, then there's no problem. We find no problem in our feelings switching as well, and we can even argue with each other about them. So if usefulness, therefore, be a source of moral sentiment, and if this usefulness be not always considered with reference to self, it follows that everything which contributes to the happiness of society recommends itself directly to our approbation and goodwill. Here is a principle which accounts in great part for the origin of morality. And what need we seek for abstruse and remote systems when there occurs one so obvious and natural? Hear that, Aristotle? What need we to search for these abstruse systems when there is one that's so obvious and natural? It's obvious that the importance of utility and the sympathy that we have with each other produces this sentiment. And a footnote to this passage adds, it is needless to push our researches so far as to ask why we have humanity or a fellow feeling with others. It is sufficient that this is experienced to be a principle in human nature. We must stop somewhere in our examination of causes, and there are in every science some general principles beyond which we cannot hope to find any principle more general. So this is a stopping point, see? There's no way you can go beyond this and say, well, the reason why we value human happiness is that it's important because da da da. Which, of course, you could do if you were Aristotle, valuing the good life as he understood it. So the positive value of utility needs no explanation, and sympathy is a brute fact. What we have here is reason, but reason with a different role, and that means it's also reason of a different kind. Where the ancients had this notion of reason as the power to discern the hierarchy of goals, now reason is really what we would call instrumental reason. It's the issue of what actually conduces to human happiness. Right? We saw that with luxury. I mean, you find out that the common belief that they had that this actually undermines human happiness and well-being is wrong, or at least in certain circumstances wrong, and we are realizing those circumstances by developing modern commercial society. I mean, it's more complex than simply a sort of general rule, but we now find in our circumstances that that is not wrong. We find that instrumentally the search for luxury is actually something which can be harnessed to everyone's benefit, and therefore we switch. So reason is a quite different kind of thing. It's not the discernment of hierarchical order here in ends. It is really instrumental reason. And therefore we get the picture of Hume, which I think is fundamentally right, but which people argue about, that he says over and over again, reason is not itself a motivating force, because what he means is that X causes Y is not a motivating force by itself. But if you value Y, then it is a motivating force. Or if you very much disvalue Y and want to avoid it, then this fact, together with that valuation, will move you. So it is not reason itself, the role of reason being restricted to instrumental reason, which does the moving. Contrast Plato, right? On the contrary, the perception of this being higher is something that deeply moves you. As a matter of fact, Plato would argue that you haven't really seen that reason is higher unless you love it. I mean, if you say, I guess reason is higher, but you know, take me back to the tavern and so on, then you haven't properly grasped it. To grasp it properly is to be moved by it. You see, it's a totally different construction. And now, this, I just want to just look at this for a second longer before I jumped to the other side of the attempt tonight to look at the other kind of reduction. This, of course, goes along with a complete reorientation of our understanding of what ethics is all about. In a sense, what Hume makes morals about is our perception of utility in our, for ourselves and others, and we respond to that. So it is really, morals is all about how we treat each other, or to use a quote from Tim Scannon's book, what we owe to each other in a certain sense. Right? Morals is about that kind of question. The paradigm question for Aristotle and Plato was, what's a really worthwhile life? And they derive how we should treat each other from their understanding of what a worthwhile life is. And we have, there's a kind of agreement in a lot of contemporary discussion to divide these two questions, and they're sometimes called ethics and morals, respectively. I mean, think of Bernard Williams, think of, even Habermas has come around to using this language here, right? Morals being the issues of how we treat each other, and ethics being issues of what really a good life is. And so we find that some of the succession out of Hume involves splitting these two and saying, well, we can make morals fairly exact, not exactly science, but I mean a study where we can get really clear answers, you know, what does conduce to the general good. But when we come to ethics, what people consider a good life, well, that's something everyone does for themselves, and there isn't a right or wrong here. I can't tell you what to do, what to be. You can't tell me what to be. And we even have a further development of the kind of Kantian. I mean, in a certain sense, Kant is overturning Hume, but still, in an important sense, downstream from Hume, because he considers the set of issues of how we should treat each other to be central, and you get the answers to them out of another kind of reason, which is universalizing vert rationalité, right? Not instrumental reason, but value reason. So, but it's still not the reason of the ancients. So we have a whole lot of absolutely fascinating issues here, and let me therefore lay out these, actually, there are four possibilities. If I don't put them on the board, I'll lay them out quickly, and then if you're all confused, just forget them and remember two, only two. I mean, there are, so you can lay them out in a kind of system from different kinds of meanings and how they are either really commanding us or demanding something, or just simply de facto what draws us. So at one end you have the nauseating, right? It's totally at one end. There's another interesting thing people discuss here, which are classical secondary properties. You have, you know, that it's clear that my perception of red, I hope I'm not colorblind, in these chairs here is something which you judge to be right. So it's not like nauseating, because you can judge it to be right or wrong. But what it is to judge it to be right or wrong is simply that people with normal apparatus, normal perceptual apparatus, say this is red, and that is some kind of light blue, and et cetera, and this is whatever it is. And that's all that it means. So in a certain sense, it's very close to nauseating. It's just how people de facto react, with this proviso, unlike the nauseating one, that we can say that people that deviate from these judgments is some problem that they have. But if they were normal, they get that. So these are two in one end of the spectrum. Then we get this Hume-derived category, which is very interesting because there is an issue of reason. There is an issue of getting it right up to a point. You can be corrected. And it can be said, look, your sentiment of rage at that poor innocent doctor who's taking the tumor out because you thought this beast was a cruel monster, your sentiment of disapprobation or rage at him is really totally wrong. It's inappropriate. Now listen to me and I'll tell you what was actually going on, right? So up to a point, this can be corrected. But it can only be corrected through instrumental reason. I'm telling you that this knife there was not there in order to inflict pain on him. It was there in order to save his life, right? So take that in and change your judgment. But the reasoning, as it were, the normative reasoning doesn't go all the way down because it stops at the point where I show you that it conduces to his utility. At that point, if you want to go on asking, well, why is that important? The answer is, I mean, you know, sorry, you are just not a normal human being if you can ask that. This is not something we can go on talking about. Whereas, in the fourth case now, the Aristotle-Plato case, we have this idea that the reasoning can go all the way down. That is, if you ask, well, why is this goal, theory, or what have you, a really valid goal, then we can give you reasons. Reason can show that. There's no where reason simply stops by saying that's where it stops. In a way, the way Hume stops us by saying we got to stop somewhere, got to be a principle somewhere, he says. And any science you arrive at a principle, you can't get beyond. And the principle we have here is that it's utility and general utility, which draws people's approbation. Well, that's not allowed for in this fourth category. So there is, if you like, nausea, vision of color, Hume, Aristotle. You see these four categories. And before I go on and look at the second half of this, and I hope I'm not going on too long here, you can see that this plays a tremendously important role in ethical life today. I mean, take ecology, take the fight to keep the planet from being destroyed and so on. Now, on one level, this can be argued out in terms of, well, look, if all the glaciers in the Himalayas melt and there is, as it were, the Ganges and the Mekong and the Yangtze River dry up seasonally at some point totally, you know, a lot of people are going to suffer. And if the level of the sea rises and Bangladesh is flooded, you know, a lot of people are going to suffer terribly. And that's certainly very important, and we can argue on that. And this is Humean type of argument, right? But you note around you the ecological movement. There are lots of people who define themselves as deep ecologists, for instance. And they aren't denying that the first reasons are important, but they're saying they aren't enough. And they're saying what? Well, they're saying properly understood, our existence in this environment, in this earth, and so on, is something that makes demands on us, that objectively calls on us to behave in a certain way towards it, to respect certain of its crucial features, to shore them up, not to destroy them, and so on. A certain demand is made on us. And here, someone reasoning in the Humean way can't really take this in. I mean, they can say, well, okay, we can understand that you feel that way. We can even maybe promote this to something everybody is supposed to feel, you know. But but it's just, again, we can take that in as a brute feeling, but not as a perception, a correct perception of what is really important here. So when Thoreau says what is in wildness is the preservation of the world, is this what? Any Thoreauvian here can tell me what the word was. Anyway, in wildness is the whatever of the world. This was meant to be an actual perception of some reality, which other people don't realize. And it might be, you know, well, I'm glad you feel that way. I feel that way too. That could be the response, but that wouldn't be doing justice to this. So this is a very, very crucial issue that we're still always discussing. Okay, what's the second kind? I mean, there's all sorts of issues. I'd love to go on about this. Maybe we could in the discussion, which is, I mean, one of the things that bedevils this is that the historical modes of these ethical views, take Aristotle's theory, Christianity, what have you, different examples I gave, all give a very profound set of reasons why that kind of reasoning is right. I mean, for instance, Aristotle ultimately is grounded in this notion of the forms as what makes the world as it is, what makes human life what it is. And, of course, Christianity is grounded in a certain notion of our relation to God and so on. And people say, well, we don't buy that anymore. But it's interesting. I don't think that settles the issue. I mean, the very interesting issue is, should we go on arguing this way even if we don't know yet or have an idea yet or have an agreed idea yet what the deeper reasons are? Nevertheless, should we go on considering some perceptions of the form, this is a higher good than that, legitimate and true. That's the issue, and we could go on about that. But first of all, let me look at the other kind of reduction. The other kind of reduction is a pure explanatory reduction. And it's an attempt to explain human life and action, which we normally consider in terms which involve purpose and people's understanding of their own situation, their purposes and their understanding of their own situation explains why they do this or don't do that and so on. That kind of explanation, which makes use of, just to speak sort of rapidly, what you might call teleology, purpose, and intentionality, their understanding of their situation, allegedly, some people hold, the proper, deeper account which can be given of this is in purely efficient causal terms. In other words, what is going on here is a sense that the Galilean-Newtonian revolution in natural science showed us that our explanation of physics and nature and so on ought to be carried on in purely efficient causal terms, that purpose and so on is not has no place here, which it very much did for the Aristotelian, the pre-modern notion of ways of explaining the world. And this applies to our explanation even of human beings. And you, I now have in my, as my sort of paradigm cases here, moving down from Aristotle and Hume, people like Dennett and Pinker that I've been reading, right? And the argument is something of the following kind. I mean, either you go along with Descartes and you think that there really is, beside the physical universe surrounding us, something totally spooky and ghostly called the mind or the soul, right? Or, if you don't do that, then you have somehow to accept that what you're now hearing from me, which may sound sensible or nonsensical, but it's meant to be logical and so on, is something that can only be emanating from my mouth because I have a brain and a nervous system and a certain amount of experience and the way this is set up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So either you're a dualist or you're not a dualist. But if you accept that it's something to do with, I mean, my saying all this is not some disembodied mind speaking, but something to do with the way my brain is working and so on, then brains, they're matter. Matter has to be explained in terms of efficient causation. So the explanation has to be in terms of efficient causation, QED. In a certain sense, I mean, you can see that there's a big, big argument going on in which I'm on the other side because I'm a, you know, a great follower of Mirabeau Ponty, and I think that this notion of our being embodied beings is the absolutely correct notion. But it's very interesting that we Mirabeau Pontyans have a totally different sense of the word embodied than do, let's say, Dennett and Pinker and so on, because we think of embodiment as the fact that we live in the world as embodied beings, that we live in the world with a sense, the sense of the world that comes from being the kind of beings we are, that some things are up, some things are down, some things are easy to reach, some things are very far to reach, and that this embodied sense and sensibility is crucial to our lives. And we can't even, we don't even have the possibility of more distant and disengaged ways of dealing with the world unless we live, already living, in this engaged form. It's a totally different notion of what embodiment means because it's embodiment of a live, active body with purposes and goals and so on, as against embodiment seen purely in terms of the causal level, the causal mechanisms that underlie this kind of action. So in a certain sense, from our point of view, there's a massive slippage in the logic of this. I mean, they start off with the Cartesian view that there are these two kinds of things, minds and bodies, and but they follow Descartes. They agree totally with Descartes, and Descartes would totally agree with this. When it comes to bodies, it's only its mechanism which counts, right? I said, okay, René, that's fine. So we agree with you totally. We just want to throw the mind out, right? And so we have embodied beings but understood purely mechanistically. And of course, this doesn't follow. But it's very interesting to read them because they never really face that. They just assume that. And I've heard Dan Dennett speak a few months ago. It's exactly the same thing. You know, if you don't explain your conscious reasoning in terms of all the little sort of gremlins there that are dumber and dumber and dumber and dumber, that then you're not materialist, he said, looking horror and gullible. Then you have some spooky stuff in there. Then, you know, it's not science. So, anyway. So you have this very powerful view. This is another kind of reduction. This is a pure explanatory reduction. And the kind of claim is made, well, you may think that the reason why Obama said this yesterday and so on was that he's figuring out that if you can get some more Republicans on side, et cetera. But no, I mean, the real point underneath is that this some kind of computer here, and wheels are running, etc., working it out. And it can be understood on this deeper level mechanistically in the same way that a homing missile or my computer can be similarly understood. There's a very profound difference in what life means and so on that's involved in this. All right, but if you take that line, you can see that you're locked into the other reduction as well. That is, the reduction that says there are no meanings which can be shown to be validly holding meanings right to the very bottom, as it were. There are only meanings that are meanings for us because at some level it's a brute fact that they're meanings for us. These two reductions can come apart. Because you think of certain kinds of Marxist who would at least partly have bought the first reduction, but who famously said, I mean, you hear these people, Lukács and others at various times, talking about mechanistic, they're materialists. We're all materialists, they say, because these are two kinds of people that call themselves materialists. We're all materialists, but these other bourgeois thinkers are mechanistic materialists or bourgeois materialists, and we are dialectical materialists or et cetera, or historical materialists. So they seem to be taking reduction one on board, but not reduction two, right? But what I'm saying is the logic of the arguments is such you couldn't do the opposite. I don't see how you could do the opposite. If you take reduction two on board, you want this mechanistic reduction, you have to buy into the debunking of any, if you like, intrinsic meanings or meanings that are meanings all the way down or meanings that can be argued for as objective and so on. At some point, you have to simply stop and reinterpret them as brute facts that we simply desire. You can see this because if you look at the way in which this kind of reduction is attempted, really, which is using computer theory, partly with some help from connectionism and so on, in order to understand our intelligent performances as kinds of computation, right? You see that they can, if this explanation were actually to work, a computer model of the human mind were actually to work, you could see how they could recuperate three of the four kinds of meanings that I laid out here, which I didn't put on the board, right? They can give a perfectly good explanation of nausea. I mean, as it just triggers this off, they can give a very good explanation of why the normal human perception of color comes out with the answers it does. They can give a perfectly good explanation, supposedly, of why it's wired into us to find that what creates human suffering is something we don't like. What creates human well-being is something that we react to. We can, positively. We can even give certain, I mean, take the whole selfish gene idea, the Dawkins selfish gene idea. You see, this is something that can explain why we have super sympathy for some people, for kin, and not for others. I mean, the idea is that a gene, of course, operates with a whole collection of genes that form an organism, but a gene that makes it more likely that whole collection will reproduce itself in the next generation will itself, of course, be more widely spread in the next generation and so on and so on. So you get the famous idea of the selfish gene, which is a very bad, very stupid image. I mean, a metaphor which constantly, they keep saying it's not a metaphor, on the next page they obviously are taking it totally seriously. I mean, they say admit it's a metaphor, and then they begin to take it totally seriously. But you can see how this works, and this can even explain why, if people get, as a matter of fact, a cathexis on their kin, and therefore do all sorts of things for the kin that they wouldn't do for others, and even sacrificing themselves, well, yeah, this will produce a situation. If, you know, what did Haldane say? I would sacrifice myself for 4 cousins and 6, I don't know, aunts or whatever. Now, you can see how this pattern, according to their way of calculating, would spread the gene wider. See, so all these things can be explained. But what couldn't be explained is the perception of real intrinsic meaning. Why? Well, because if this isn't a real issue, what is really higher, really better, and so on, then in cases of non-delusion, in cases where I'm not deluded, it would have to be the case that something's falling under the category of really meaningful, really good, etc., would draw me. In other words, it would have real causal power in those cases, the real causal power of drawing me towards it. But this is an impossible property to fit into a mechanistic account, counting pure efficient causation, right? Because how could a property of really fitting a certain normative concept be one that, as it were, allowed the entities instantiating it to have this constant causal power? The only thing that could have a constant causal power is something that is just brute cathected, something of, you know, X or Y that is operative and powerful because it is brutally cathected, and then it would be so. So in order to recognize the efficacy of this kind of discernment, you'd have to translate it into the other kind. You have to move it from the Aristotle category to what I'm calling the Hume category, right? And then you can do everything else, supposedly. Because if you allow all the, the computer model of the mind, all kinds of instrumental reason can be coped with by, and according to this mechanistic account, then consciousness really gets them a little bit. But then they divide it up into 3 things. Consciousness is in one sense self-consciousness, so some notion of the self figures, and well, that could be in a computation. And then another element of it is the conscious planning, and if that's instrumental reason, well, that can fit supposedly into the explanation. What can't be fitted into is raw feels or sentience. Well, let's forget that for a moment. But they think they can get everything, but what they can't get is intrinsic value. As a matter of fact, there's something even, I have to read you this last thing from Pinker, How the Mind Works. There's certain pathos in this. It comes to the end of the book, and he says, I've got this theory, which is a mixture of sort of computer causal account and a evolutionary account. Wow, I mean, you can't get more. And it shows exactly how the mind works. And it really can explain everything. Now, there are just a few things I can't fit into this. And there's a list of 6. Consciousness, the self, free will, meaning, knowledge, and morality. I mean, apart from these trivial questions, it's all explained. Anyway, but so that's where I want to stop because I've gone on too long. I've tried to show how these different kinds of reduction feed into each other, or in some cases against each other, in the case of certain Marxists, but in our present climate, very much they're working in synergy with each other to make, in various ways, the idea of, as were, intrinsic meaning really unthinkable, I mean, impossible, right? So this is the situation that we face. This is what we have to argue about or argue against and so on. But I wanted tonight to try to put the strands together. So let me stop there and let's have a discussion and see what we want to go into, what we don't want to go into, and so on. Yes, thank you very much. Tremendously kind. Thank you. So, so how should we do this? I mean, do you want me just, yeah. I'll just, you want to, or do you want to recognize her? Oh, it's certainly, no.
Knowledge experts in about
knowledge, I mean, experts has the wrong ring because we think of them, I know this, yeah, you have the same experience, people say to you sometime, phone you up in the hospital, are you an ethicist? Are you an ethicist? And, you know, we have an anesthetist on the board and we have, and they've got the wrong model. I mean, if you're Aristotelian, which I am, it's a totally wrong model. But so if that's what expert means, no. But there are people who are wiser than others on some of these issues. Yes. So in that very strong sense.
But it's knowledge, if not this kind of more refined expertise.
But it's knowledge is not the kind of easily communicable expertise, or at least the difficulties in communication of this expertise are different from those of the expertise of a statistician or someone who's going to tell you what stress tables are when you're building your bridge and so on. It's a different kind of knowledge. Now, one of the big differences, and this is what I would get in this other part of the talk I didn't give, one of the big differences is that you get the other kind of expertise by disengaging, emotionally disengaging from the area you're studying. You study the stress tables and so on, and you can't let your aesthetic feelings are be part of the equation. But you don't manage to get a really good sense of what's really humanly important without, you know, being moved in certain way by by the situations and by the various objects that you're judging, which is why it was always it's always been possible to read this just in a human way, I mean, just a brute convexus. But a more refined psychological understanding of how human beings operate and how reason operates here, I think, really undercuts that. That's why it's a very different kind of expertise. I mean, if somebody spoke to you in a kind of robotic tone of voice, like, you know, Dr. Spock or something, or that, Star Trek and so on, and say, I want to tell you what the highest form of life is, you would find it impossible to, you wouldn't find it credible. But if somebody speaks with a certain amount of fire and you think insight, it is credible, because this is a different kind of knowledge. It's not something that can be can be disengaged from. Yes, I mean, there are all sorts of
yes, I'd like to ask why you think that this notion of intrinsic value is actually the only thing that remains outside of the possible reactions that you have identified. I mean, the notion that, I mean, the ancient notion of finding an objective value in life seems to depend on an objective description of the world and our place in it. So I guess it's legitimate to think of Aristotle giving us a theory that could be amenable to a reduction of this kind. So it so happens, as a matter of fact, that we as human beings are structured in such a way that for us happiness means theory. I mean, there is nothing simply rules out completely, if you want, also mechanistic view of the world and of human beings in it.
No, you could give a quasi-mechanistic economy. I mean, I want to say again, say it the last time, I don't buy for a minute that they even get as far with their reductions as they claim to get, right? But if you give them that, they don't have room for it. Let's take this Theoria case as a very good case, right? Well, when Aristotle's talking about it, he's talking about a pursuit of knowledge, the kind of knowledge where you understand it as being higher, which means that the kind of knowledge you're seeking and the kind of issues you're dealing with, right, are those which are really central and important. Now, you could say, well, it's a fact that human beings are curious, right? I mean, they just want to know certain things, right? And as a matter of fact, even the first line of the metaphysics could be read this way, human beings desire to know, right? But this would be in a way of accounting for a certain amount of human activity, which Aristotle is also trying to account for, which didn't recognize here an intrinsic meaning, but people carrying it out would be carrying it out in a different way. Because in virtue of the intrinsic meaning, for those who are really, you know, interested in science, there are all sorts of, there's a whole ethic of how you carry it on and what's really important and what's cheating and what's not cheating and so on, which follows from this. See, that's the, and that is something which follows from understanding this as an intrinsic good. So it's always possible to explain something like the pattern, which Hume does, as simply a brute fact. But it's a different thing when you're trying to make the discriminations in how you carry it out. See? And you claim that certain discriminations of how you really properly carry it out are better than others, which can only be claimed as against, I just feel like carrying it out this way and you feel like carrying it out that way. No. The claim is higher, then that has to be justified by something like intrinsic meaning. Well, who's psychology? I mean, there are various theories in psychology. Yeah, a lot of psychology would part company with this, but a lot of philosophy. I mean, a lot of philosophers have bought into this. You know, Dan Dennett's a philosopher. Yeah, he totally bought into this. So I don't think it's we're talking about two disciplines or subject matters and so on. We're talking about two very powerful strands that oppose themselves right through the academy. You go into the political science department, you go to the sociology department, you go into the psychology department, linguistics department, philosophy department. You can line up these people against each other. And they may be differential numbers. But yeah. No, I've read, you know, some things of him and so on, but he doesn't seem to be on the same wavelength with these other people.
Yes.
Yeah. Not in the same wavelength, yeah. Right. Which is an example of, I mean, in the same, yeah, disciplines. Now there's a couple of hands way back there, but there's a keel as well, yeah. You have to run around.
Back in the intrinsic meaning of Aristotle philosophy, is there any limit for which you could say that there is some kind of limit, whether it's a procedural or a formal limit, to argument or disagreement within that box?
What I mean, how would the, what would a limit look like?
Proponent A says on some question, this is the basic value, the basic good here, and proponent B says, no, this is the basic good, and they have to have some common reference to the standard. Is there an infinite regress of standard?
Yeah. Well, I think that that misconceived the question, I think, is not it's a une question not posée. Because I think how this kind of argument works, this is the way I see it. That I say, well, you know, theory is very important, and you say something else very important. And then we start talking about human life. And it's the whole understanding of human life within the context of that we hope to make our case, right? Or maybe not referring to the whole, but arranging around within the whole to pick up relevant arguments, right? So that we can make our case. It there isn't a point where it stops. I mean, you have a model of argument that why A? Well, B proves A. Why B? Well, C proves B. If you're arguing deductively like that, then it has to come to an end somewhere, or else we drop dead, right? What's that? That's right. But nobody in their right mind argues about this kind of thing that way. You see, what they don't say, well, I got a knockdown argument why theoria, because theoria is ping. He said, what's good about ping? Well, it's pong. No, that's not the way. It's an attempt. The argument is really, it's hermeneutics. It's an attempt to give an interpretation of the whole of human life such that it jumps out from this, if you see it that way, and I can convince you to see it that way, that that is supremely important and not something else. So it potentially never comes to an end. I mean, there's not a... It's a kind of expanding universe in a certain sense, which never reach the outside of it. Deductive arguments are really not in their place here. You know, Aristotle only used them after, as it were, after this hierarchy had been established, right? Then you can use, you know, the practical syllogism operates there. What do I have to do? I have to do the courageous thing. What's the courageous thing? And so on. Then you, yeah. But in order to, I mean, the Nicomachean Ethics isn't, as a whole, which is trying to get you into seeing the good life in his terms, is not a deductive argument. And it doesn't work that way. So, you see, I think that this is just a very incorrect model for what's actually going on. And maybe a little bit infected by the Kantianism, K1N1. I mean, you see what I mean? That you can think that you can get these absolutely clear and knockdown arguments, like, you know, could you universalize this maxim? No, so it's wrong. Well, okay, but then that itself you can't get going unless you can convince me anyway about something about human beings that I presently don't believe. Okay, go on. Come back.
Yeah.
Well, you can also go outside, but yeah. Yeah, because... No, why? No, you could. I mean, it's possible to make a judgment. Well, you know, Aristotle wasn't so wrong in his society, but when you look at it now, and some of those judgments are, I think, correct, but other judgments wouldn't allow for other judgments about other things that wouldn't allow for that. But you're right, the whole historical record is there, as far as we know it, to allow you to argue both these. And in that way, it's endless. I mean, it's potentially endless. We may never convince each other, but the And it's, but the endlessness is a good endlessness. There's always somewhere else for the argument to go. See what I mean? It's, yeah. Yeah, I reject dualism and reject Dennett as well. That would be my position. Yeah, exactly. That's, you know, I think that the whole Cartesian idea of a kind of disconnected mind and so on from the body doesn't make any sense. But the big issue is, what are the concepts, terms, etc., in which you have to understand us as living beings? And can you really sideline totally, if you like, give teleology and intentionality? And I think you can't. As a matter of fact, I think it's such, it's in some ways an immense proposition, an immensely implausible claim to think that you can. And you have to issue a lot of promissory notes that we're going to be able to explain this and this and this, you know. I mean, quite a, there are all sorts of things that don't really go very well with it. Like, for one thing, the most people who know something about how the brain, you know, more or less organizes itself in early life, etc., really reject the computer model totally. You see, this is a real mistake. People like Edelman, Changeur, Jean-Pierre Changeur in France, and you go on and on and on with the whole list of them. They find this really wild. They don't think that has anything to do with how we operate. So the whole set of promissory notes here are very far from being redeemed, let me put it that way. But I mean, you know, we won't know till the end of the argument if there ever is one. But I kill you.
Just a question about the question of the parcel. People like James and so on, for the Merleau-Ponty version of the embodied subject. It's always their version of it.
Yeah.
One diagnosis of it might be that there is two distinctions, one between the body and mind, and the other between the point of view of engagement and the point of view of sort of detachment.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of Merleau-Ponty's idea of an embodied subject is really the idea of the body, which is actually engaged.
Yes.
Right? So it sort of scrambles the distinctions. It won't allow the two distinctions to coincide.
Yes.
Right? And if that's right, it looks as if the fundamental distinction by Merleau-Ponty's lines and your lines, which I agree with this, is that the view distinction is a point of view distinction, or a point of view dualism to some extent, but if there is one. And one could happily reject the other dualism. And Descartes was partly responsible for this because he insisted on treating subjectivity as a substance.
Yeah.
And so he created a sort of objectivist orientation. Of you know, detachment, etc. And this year you were certainly an argumentator insisted on the point of view. But I'm just really following up on the last question. I'm curious about people who are prepared to say Davidson, for instance, and a number of others, who oppose the mechanistic view, you know, the thinker. And are prepared to say the subject is in charge, that it is a site of normativity and value and so on, which is irreducible. So it can't be
seem mechanistic terms, etc. But there's a sort of shallowness by glance of this Aristotelian picture talking about. There's a shallowness about it because it leaves all the enchantment to the subject, right? And it doesn't have a sort of corresponding sort of objective meaning, as you put it.
That's right.
Or whatever. And that leaves the very idea of enchantment incomplete or shattered. That I don't know if it even sometimes makes sense. And it's interesting that if you leave it that way, then you can have a picture in which you people are keen to totalize one or the other point of view. So you have Deleuze and Orwell completely totalizing the detached third person. But you have somebody like Sartre, who tends to totalize the subjective or the first person point of view. So, well, we don't really learn about ourselves from psychoanalysis, that's all that thing. And so, it's really a pretense. It's all subjective anyway. You're just pretending that you... So really, you don't get the deep thing. You don't get Aristotle's point of view. You see the two enchantments as it were depending on it.
Yeah, yeah. But I think there's a deep connivance, you'd say in French. I mean, a deep sort of... they're in cahoots, these two standpoints, right, the extreme standpoints. There's a very interesting line in Pinker in which, of course, people gave him a lot of trouble about his evolutionary psychology and so on. Well, aren't you buying into sexism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, it's totally untrue of poor Pinker. He isn't, you know, he doesn't feel that way. So they say, well, I mean, if you have all these, you know, genes, obviously, in you that are pushing you to behave in as a man in a totally sexist way, and so on. What do you do about that? And he said, well, I tell my genes to go jump in the lake. But now, that's a very interesting remark, because suddenly you have almost a Sartrean type of, you know, radical choice here. But why do these things, they do fit together, you see, because that whole objectivizing standpoint implicitly puts the subject in a situation of incredible control and domination, which, of course, is sometimes an invitation to a totally technocratic approach, right? You know, we really understand this, we're going to advise governments, and we'll be able to organize the world, and, Skinner thought we would get totally rid of alienation altogether if we just had nobody brought up by their parents, you know, we bring up all the kids, said, okay, so we'd be more bonkers than we are today. But you know, it can be that kind of total control, or it can be, well, I'm totally master of my own house. I decide, my values tell me not, so I'm going to control this. There's a kind of flip between these two, which is easy to do because there's an underground sympathy between the two. I mean, what's the word for connivance? I mean, there's an underground, they're in cahoots, underground, between the two. Yes. Could you come closer? Yeah, I think there has to be a kind of distorted self-understanding here at a certain point. Yeah, but sorry. No, I'm doing the same thing. There has to be a kind of distorted self-understanding. You see, if you think that you can totally understand yourself from that third-person standpoint, and there has to be a devaluing of the kinds of intuitions on which we all live in actually carrying out our lives. But people can, you know, people can live in a kind of split-level way. I mean, I once knew a friend of mine who had a friend of his who was, they're both rational choice theorists. And a friend was saying, oh, God, it's a terrible decision. This woman I'm with, she wants it to become more serious, and do I marry her or not? And so his friend said, well, let's settle the matrix. And he said, no, this is serious. At a certain point, life breaks in. I mean, you know. Thank you very much.